So today we complete the model that we've been exploring over the last, believe it or not, 9 days. We're going to look at a remaining two clusters of mental events, both Kushala Chaitadharmas and Klesha and Upaklesha Chaitadharmas. We're going to look at a cluster concerning mindfulness and a cluster concerning cruelty or harmfulness and overcoming the same. So let's first of all look at mindfulness, and this is I think some quite important material here. Usually this particular mental event, the Kushala Chaitadharma of Apramada, is dealt with as it were yesterday, and Upeksha would be dealt with today, but I felt it would be quite a good note to end on, and anyway there was quite a lot of material under this heading, so I've transposed them. You'll have noticed anyway generally that I've arranged the lists according to my taste. Yes, so the Kushala Chaitadharma is Apramada, and the Upakleshas, there's no direct klesha corresponding to this, the Upakleshas are Pramada, Asamprajanya and Mushita Smritita. They you know, arguably could be put under different headings, but they all belong together in my mind, at least. And of course, we've already had Smriti as a Vinayata Chaitadharma. You remember, it's the third of the Vinayata Chaitadharmas after Chanda and Adimoksha, and before Samadhi and Prajna. So it's dealt with there as a neutral factor, which, when it's approached in a skillful way, is part of the build-up to getting closer and closer up to the real nature of the object. So here it's sort of implied again under the heading of Apramada. So we've got these three upakleshas, Pramada, Asamprajanya, and Mushita Smritita, which imply really not just Apramada, but Samprajanya and Smriti. So we've got three terms, each of which could be translated as mindfulness, and in fact often is, in translations of the Pali Canon, translations of Sanskrit texts. All these terms, the Pali equivalents, are translated as mindfulness. I notice, for instance, in Bhante's new translation of the Dhammapada, that the Pamada Vagga is translated as the chapter on mindfulness. But usually the term mindfulness, as we use it, is quite vague. You know, we often talk about the need for more mindfulness. Do we have enough emphasis on mindfulness in the movement? That sort of thing. But I don't think we're all that clear exactly what it is that we mean. And I think what's useful about these three terms, in their positive and negative forms, is that they clarify and explore the range of meanings in the term mindfulness. Really, when we're talking about mindfulness, we need to be referring both to Apramada, Samprajanya and Smriti. We need all three, and probably other qualities as well, which may be associated. But these are three that are primarily clustered together. They cover the full range of meaning of what mindfulness is. At the same time, we have to recognise they're not used very exactly. Some traditions use them in different ways to others. And in the scriptures, it's fairly clear they're not given a very precise technical meaning. You often get sati and sampajanna, which is the Pali version of smriti and sampajanya, used just as a compound. And although later commentaries do accord very specific meanings to the individual terms, I don't think that's what's really intended in the original scriptures. It's a sort of general quality of mindfulness. So the interpretation I'm going to give is perhaps not going to accord with all the different interpretations you may come across. It's, well, my own understanding, based largely on Tibetan versions of Asanga's presentation of the 51 mental events. Both Kelsang Gyatso and Geshe Rabten base their accounts on the traditions going back to the Abhidharma Samuchaya of the Sangha. And it's from them that I've drawn the primary understanding of these terms. In some ways, it differs a bit from Bhante's and from the Theravada one, but in certain respects, it's the same. Anyway, we have to recognise again and again that these are not really, in the end, technical terms. They're attempts to indicate spiritual values, spiritual states, which we should be trying to develop, and that they can always be interpreted in different ways. It's quite obvious, looking at the 51 mental events and looking at the 7 or 8 different accounts of them that we have available to us in English, and then referring to Pali texts, to Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha, and so on, these terms are not very exact. And even though some of the accounts are so clear and definite, well, another account could be equally clear and definite, but giving it a different meaning. So, in other words, I'm trying to excuse the fact that I may be differing from Bhante and other people. We're dealing with the human heart, not with the mathematics. So let's start with the term that's most commonly used for mindfulness, which is smriti, or sati, in Pali. We've already seen quite a bit about smriti, but I want here to apply it more directly to mindfulness rather than to keeping the mind focused for meditation. We've seen that smriti, the root meaning of smriti is memory. In fact, it's etymologically connected with the English word memory. So it's the retaining in mind of a previous impression. You've experienced something, you've seen something, you've thought of something, and you think of it again. So that's the sort of basic meaning of smriti. But in the context of spiritual life and practice, it means specifically recurring to a skillful object, so that you keep that skillful object in your mind. You keep your mind coming back to it, so that you hold your mind on that skillful object. So it's the ability to hold on to what is spiritually important, what is spiritually significant. It has the significance, especially in meditation, of keeping your mind on the object of meditation, so that your mind is focused on the breath, or on the person you're directing metta to, or your visualized Buddha or Bodhisattva. So you keep your mind steady on it. You keep it returning to it. And as we've seen in the Vinayata Chaitadharmas, it's the basis for the development of samadhi, that absorption in the object which breaks down the rigidity of the distinction between subject and object, which is experienced on the Karmaloka plane. So that's the first implication of smriti. The second implication is a bit more broad. It's to do with being able to watch your mental states, just seeing what arises, what objects appear to the mind. So in that sense, it's a bit like Dhamma Vichaya. Well, it is Dharma Vichaya, and it's a kind of preliminary basis for what we'll see is Apramada. But it's just being aware of whatever arises in your mind, noting it, and letting it go. Of course, it's also watching and knowing what's going on in your body and your feelings and so forth. It's the four satipatthana. But just noting them, just observing them. Then it's the maintaining of your vows and commitments, keeping in mind what it is that you've committed yourself to, what it is that you're working on, that you've undertaken. So in that sense, smriti is a vital aspect of going for refuge to the three jewels. As we said when we looked at this before, you can have a very strong feeling for the three jewels. You can say very strongly and sincerely that you commit yourself, but unless you can bear that commitment in mind, then it's ineffective. So smriti is the quality that holds your commitment in mind and keeps it as a sort of permanent part of your overall drive and direction. Smriti is also the function that holds in mind what you've learned. So if you study the Dharma, you need to remember what you've learned. So Smriti is the basis for Chintamayi Prajna, and therefore for Bhavanamayi Prajna. Because once you've heard the Dhamma in Shrutamayi Prajna, well, you have to remember it so that you can reflect on it and so that you can meditate upon it and put the full weight of your samadhi-soaked mind behind it. So Smriti has the connotation of maintaining concentration, maintaining memory of what you've learned. Of course, more generally, it's the basis for an ordered and useful life. It's doing what you said you would do. It's turning up on time for things. It's not forgetting things that you've undertaken, and so on. And when we were discussing mindfulness with Bhante at Majjhimaloka recently, he was rather emphasising this end of mindfulness. He thought people were a bit too concerned with watching their mental states and so forth when they couldn't even turn up on time, or, you know, forgot to do what they said they were going to do, or were rather insensitive towards others. So he felt that there should be quite an emphasis on just ordinary practical mindfulness. You can't really hope to have any deeper and more developed form of mindfulness unless you can do the things that you've undertaken to do in an ordinary sense. You should be reliable. That's a manifestation of Smriti, and so on. And with Smriti, you organize your life, you order your life, so that you can achieve things, so that you can get things done. And you don't live in such a mess and a muddle that you're permanently forgetting things, losing your track, forgetting what you're doing, and so on. So Smriti comes down even to that most basic level, which Bhante sees as a very important basis for much more sort of finely tuned and pointed aspects of Smriti. So Smriti is keeping the continuity of focus. And in this sense, it directly opposes Vikshepa. You remember we saw Vikshepa is the failure to maintain Manaskara. Something is before your mind connects with it in the act of conscious attention, but then Vikshepa draws your mind off onto another object. Smriti holds your mind to that object, so that you continue to focus upon it. Therefore, you can enter much more deeply into it in samadhi. So this is Smriti. Mushita Smritita is just the opposite of that. It's the forgetfulness that lets go of the wholesome object. And in this sense, it's quite closely connected to Vikshepa. But it's got a much stronger connotation of wrong memory, if you see what I mean. It's not just that you forget, it's that you remember the wrong things. So there you are concentrating on the breath and trying to hold your attention to it, and your mind goes to something else. Some attractive object that is probably connected with sensuous craving or whatever, where your mind goes to that. That is Mushita Smritita. And it's amazing because you can actually become quite concentrated on an object that's at least less than skillful, let's say. So it's sliding off the wholesome onto the unwholesome and holding on to it. So it is an act of attention, it is an act of memory, but it's wrong memory. And of course, memory is very much activated by habit. Memory is quite strongly connected with karma. It's what comes to our minds is often karma vipaka. So memory is quite strongly activated, charged by our previous actions and concerns. What comes into our mind is what's been charged up in the past. So, by giving attention to something in the past, well, it will keep coming back into your mind. It is very interesting watching that taking on permanent celibacy, brahmacharya. You just notice that you've got to put up with all the attention and energy you put into sex over the years. You just got to put up with it until it dies away and hope that you're not putting more energy into it. So it sort of reveals quite a bit of what's going on in the mind. What keeps on coming into our minds is what we've put in there in the past. I think we really need to pay quite a bit of attention to that, because it's an indication that we've been giving our energy to things that at least overtly are not that skillful, or just a bit of a distraction, or whatever, or that have some deeper meaning which we're not really following through. So with Mushita Smritata, a wholesome object comes into our minds, we don't make it fully conscious. We sort of put it before our minds, but we don't fully clarify it. And we just slide off onto something else, onto something that's a distraction or less than skillful. So that means that there's weak concentration in meditation. We're not able to focus our minds on the object of meditation. We slide off. We have very little ability to be heedful of our mental states. We're not able to make clear what our mental states are, because our mind is constantly sliding off in wrong memory. We don't keep our commitments because we fail to hold them in our minds. We forget what we've learned because we're not making what we've learned fully present to us and engaging ourselves sufficiently strongly with it. And that means there's no reflection, and therefore no meditation, a meditational realization. And our lives are chaotic and ineffective because we're not really fully clear about what we're doing, and we're constantly sort of distracted and carried away by the false memory, the wrong memories that keep on coming to us. And one should say, one should emphasize, that it's not only a trouble to us, it's a trouble to other people. Forgetfulness in you is not just your forgetfulness, it affects others. So smriti is an essential function of spiritual life, and we have to work quite hard against mushita smritata, which is instinctually and habitually based memory of things that are at best pretty trivial and at worst actually negative. It's sometimes quite alarming when you go on retreat and you do become much more aware of what's going on in your mind, just how much of your memory space is taken up with things that really don't matter very much and that are even quite annoying to keep on having them come into your minds. But those are the manifestations of mushita smritata. So, I'm afraid it goes further. We've next got samprajanya. Samprajanya has that particle in it, nya, which is connected with the English word knowledge, knowing, etymologically. It's got a very strong connotation of intelligence and understanding, not just of perception or experience. Samprajanya is usually translated as something like clear comprehension, sometimes as discernment. But I think clear comprehension is quite good. It has got much more to do with understanding and intelligence, and it's said even to be an aspect of prajna in the sense that we talked about it in the Vinayata Chaitadharmas. You remember the last of the Vinayata Chaitadharmas is analytical intelligence. Well, samprajanya is that analytical intelligence applied in the way that I'm going to make clear now. So samprajanya is seeing what's going on in yourself and around you and putting it in its proper moral and spiritual perspective. It's not just being aware in a neutral sort of way, but it's putting it in the biggest, widest context of values, so that you understand what you're doing and what's going on in the light of those values, in the light of that moral perspective. The Theravada tradition analyses samprajanya in terms of four aspects, which I think are quite useful in making this clear. First of all, there's the clear comprehension of purpose, samprajanya connected with your purpose. So in this case, you know what's going on, you know what you're doing, and you know why you're doing it. And you know the way in which your short-term objective relates to your long-term objective. So you have an overall objective of moving towards the three jewels, and you see the way in which what you're doing now fits into that long-term objective. So that you're conscious all the time of how you're sort of movement all fits together. Even if you're doing something that's mundane, it's just part of keeping your body alive, if you're eating, whatever, washing or whatever, you're conscious that you're doing that in order to sustain the body so that the body can be a basis for your spiritual practice so that you can move towards the three jewels. This is the way it's spoken of. So you know what you're doing and why you're doing it. Of course, this isn't always an easy matter because, for instance, in certain kinds of creative activity, in a sense, you don't know what you're doing. I was reading a biography of Kipling recently, and he was talking about starting a story without knowing how the story was going to work out. And he said that a lot of his effort was to not let himself know how the story was going to work out. But in a sense, that is a purpose, if you see what I mean. He knew what he was doing, but what he was doing was not letting himself know what he was doing. You get what I mean. So we shouldn't take this idea of purpose too sort of mechanically or superficially or rationalistically. Having a sense of purpose doesn't necessarily mean knowing exactly what you're doing in a kind of mathematical sense almost. Well, you remember a great Englishman, I hope the Irish will forgive me, Cromwell said that a man never knows not where he... A man never flies so high unless he knows not where he flies. If you don't know where you're going, well, you fly even higher. But with that paradox in mind, let's nonetheless come back to the idea of mindfulness of purpose. You do need to have some sense that you're moving in the direction that aligns with your ultimate purpose. It may not be fully conscious to you, but more often than not, it's an intuition that you have that you're moving in the right direction. Then there's clear comprehension of suitability. And suitability means that you have, you know what you're doing, but you've chosen the appropriate means to that end. You know what your purpose is, and you know how what you're doing relates to that. So you're clear that you're doing it in the best possible way in the circumstances, and you're able to clarify how best to go about it. So again, this all could sound a bit mechanical, but you get the point that you know what you're doing and why you're doing it and how what you're doing relates to what you're trying to get to. Then the next area of clear comprehension is clear comprehension of what's known as the pasture or field, which the gochara, which means the field of meditation, the domain of meditation. So what this means is that you're able to link your ordinary experience to your meditation practice. And there are two senses in which this can be done. The first sense is that, for instance, you've got a meditation subject like the mindfulness of breathing. When you come out of meditation, you can't go around all the time being mindful of your breath. But you can be generally mindful, and you can try and keep in contact with your body and with your breath from time to time, so that when you do come to sit to do the mindfulness of breathing, it's just a sort of intensification in a certain direction of an underlying mindfulness that you're keeping all the time. In the case of visualization practice, meditation on the Buddha or Bodhisattva, well, you retain some sense of the Buddha or Bodhisattva as with you throughout the day. I remember Bhante talking about those practices that end with the dissolution of the Buddha or Bodhisattva into your heart. The end of the Manjushri Stuti Sadhana, for instance, Manjushri shrinks into a tiny sort of ball of energy which comes forward, touches the crown of your head, and goes into your heart. And Bhante said, well, you should only do that if you retain throughout the day a sense of Manjushri in your heart. So that in that way you keep a link of mindfulness of your meditation practice all day long. Of course, there are other ways of doing that. For instance, you can keep on reciting the mantra, or you can just sort of constantly refer to your Buddha or Bodhisattva. You can constantly sort of almost use them as a kind of inspiration for your action, or even a standard for your action, a source of apatrapya. But yes, the important thing is that through this aspect of clear comprehension, you retain a link with your meditation practice throughout the day. If you don't do that, your meditation is not going to really work. Bhante was stressing this again quite recently, saying that we were sort of asking, protesting that it was too difficult to get into dhyana, and so many people didn't get into dhyana. Couldn't we stop talking about dhyana, please, Bhante? And he was adamant, no, that we should be getting into dhyana. If we weren't getting into dhyana, it was because we were in the hindrances. And if we were in the hindrances, it was because we were developing and maintaining the hindrances throughout the day. So that your activities during the day are the nivarana bhavana, and then you're hoping to do the dhyana bhavana, where you can't sort of just oscillate like that. 23 hours of hindrances and 1 hour of dhyana. It's not going to work. You have to be working against the hindrances outside meditation practice in order to experience a deepening of concentration in meditation. So that's the first sense of clear comprehension of practice. The second is that you have a strong sense of practice all the time in a more direct way. And perhaps something like a constant practice of Dhamma Vichaya would apply here. You're all the time, you know what you're working on. All the time, you're in every action of your life, you are applying yourself to spiritual effort, and you're conscious of that. So you make your life your meditation. And in this sense, mindfulness is a life practice. And perhaps we need to make much more of that generally. Finally, there's amoha. Samprajanya. Amoha being, as we've seen, non-delusion, in other words, wisdom ultimately, that being mindful to the greatest possible extent, being conscious to the greatest possible extent. And what this amounts to is keeping a constant contact with the ultimate context of reality, so that in everything that you do, you retain some awareness, some reminder of the ultimate nature of things. Of course, this may be included already in your recollection of the Buddha or Bodhisattva to whom you are devoted. By doing that, you retain some connection with the ultimate nature of things. It may be by living with one of the Lakshanas and the corresponding samadhi which is seen through it, so to speak. You're constantly reflecting on all your experience in the light of the Lakshana that you are at that time devoting yourself to penetrating. So in one way or another, you make reflection on the ultimate nature of things inform your every action, so that you're never too far from a consideration of how things really are. So these are the four aspects of samprajanya that the Theravada tradition, the commentarial tradition, glosses on the term samprajanya, and I think it's quite helpful to enable us to understand what samprajanya is. This awareness of what we're doing and its whole context and how it fits into the broadest possible context, so that all the time we're possessed of an understanding, a broad understanding of what we're doing, where we're going, and so on. Even if that is not a sort of conceptual understanding, it may be more an intuitive or even imaginative understanding. It may be more like a myth than a set of rules or commandments or formulation. It may be just a sense of what we're doing. Asamprajanya is, of course, just lack of clarity. I don't really know what's going on. Or only have a rough analysis of the situation that we find ourselves in, so that you're just there and you've only got some sort of vague idea of what's going on. You sometimes see people in that sort of state. Well, you sometimes, unfortunately, don't see yourself, because by definition when you're in it you're not aware enough of yourself, but you see other people, they really do look as if they don't know what's going on. They sort of walking across the room, and you get the impression they're not altogether clear where they are or where they're going. And sometimes you even see somebody just sort of stop in the middle of the room, and it's quite clear they haven't a clue what's going on. So that is often, at least, a samprajanya, just a failure to really identify where you are, what you're doing, where you're going, how what you're doing relates to your ultimate purpose in life, and of any kind of broader context, the ultimate context of reality. Yes, you just don't know what's going on in your body, your speech, or your mind. You don't know where your hands are. You don't know what you're saying, and you don't know what your mind is doing. This is asamprajanya. There's no clear purpose. You're not measuring the suitability of what you're doing to the ends that you're pursuing. You've forgotten your practice. You're not relating what you're doing moment by moment to the specific meditation and more general practice that you've taken up. And you've got no thought of the ultimate nature of things. So you don't relate what you're doing to the truth of things. And as samprajanya, of course, is the very opposite of that. It's a clear understanding of where you are, what your body is doing, what's going on in your speech. You're aware of the motivations, what's going on in your mind. You're aware of your mental states. The Buddha says that all the time he knows what he's feeling. All the time he knows what mental states are arising. This is clear comprehension. And of course, you know them, not just in the sense that you perceive them, but you know their value. You place them within a broader context. So finally, we come to the third of these terms that cover the field of mindfulness, and that's apramada, non-heedlessness. I've got it right this time, non-heedlessness. Pramada is heedlessness. The word pramada, the negative term, indicates intoxication or even madness. It's a carelessness, a negligence, a lack of responsibility, even a kind of recklessness. So apramada is heedfulness, non-heedlessness, care and responsibility. There's a definite feeling tone to apramada. You actually care about what you're doing, and you want to do what is right, and you have a strong sense of responsibility for your own actions and for whatever it is that you've undertaken. In the Abhidharma analysis, apramada is said to consist of virya combined with alobha, advesha, and amoha. You remember we saw that upeksha is also has that same combination, but apramada is a bit like sort of the early phases of upeksha. It's a very definite effort to keep the mind clear of lobha, dvesha, and moha, of craving, hatred, and ignorance or unawareness. You're on guard. It's the mindfulness that watches mental states arising, discriminates them as unskillful or skillful, and holds the unskillful at bay, preserving the skillful. So it's, yes, there are two aspects to it. First of all, the cherishing of the skillful. And cherishing, I think, is a well-chosen word. This is, apramada implies a sort of love for those skillful states, a very strong desire for them. Apramada, in this sense, is quite a warm mental event. It's got a definite emotional tone. So you want the skillful, you're attracted to the skillful, and you hold on to it as much as you can. So that's the first side. The other side is that it's repulsed from the unskillful. It's a definite revulsion against the unskillful. So it guards you against the unskillful. So it's a fundamental protective quality of the mind, which is very closely connected to the idea of guarding the doors of the senses, for instance. You watch what's coming in through the gates of the senses, and you discriminate. This is a basis for unskillfulness. This is a basis for skillfulness. And you choose whether to respond or not. So, pramada is everything that apramada is not. It's heedlessness. It's a kind of mental recklessness. It's not just not watching the mind. It's actually a sort of desire to act unrestrainedly. There's a kind of tension involved in apramada. If you are vigilant, if you're heedful, you are having to restrain yourself. You're having to hold yourself in from acting unskillfully. And that implies some kind of tension, which is inevitable in spiritual life. If you really are trying to lead a moral life, it cannot, at least to begin with, be without struggle. But pramada is the strong feeling not to watch, not to discriminate, indeed to go along with, to give in to your unskillful motivations. It's a deluded mental factor that wishes to act without restraint. That's the Abhidhamma Kosha definition. A deluded mental factor that wishes to act without restraint. Well, you know the feeling. You're just fed up with being under restraint, but you want to sort of burst out and go free, even if that involves doing something unskillful. Well, perhaps especially if that involves doing something unskillful. I tend to think that the aspect of mindfulness that's involved in the term apramada is under sort of appreciated amongst us. In some ways, I think it's the most important aspect of mindfulness for us. We tend to emphasise mindfulness as, knowing exactly what the carpet feels like under your feet, a sort of almost mechanical kind of observation of your sensations and so forth. And we miss this more strongly ethical dimension of mindfulness, which it seems to me is possibly the most important. Of course, you need to be aware of what's going on, and mindfulness of your sensations and so forth is very important basis for that. But I think the most important thing is that apramada is in place, and that you're constantly watchful for the arising of the unskillful, and to maintain yourself against it, and to maintain the skillful. So important is this, of course, that the Buddha himself gave a lot of attention to it. There's the whole of one vagga of the Dhammapada devoted to apramada. And the Buddha says, mindfulness, that is apramada, or apamada in Pali, is the way to the immortal. Unmindfulness, pramada, is the way to death. Those who are mindful do not die, whereas the unmindful are like the dead. So he equates lack of apramada with spiritual death, and he equates apramada with spiritual life, you could say. Presumably because if you're not heedful, well, you're only half there. You're just a bundle of instincts and of reactive forces. You're not really an individual. You're not really a moral individual. You have no stature. You don't stand out. You're just part of the instinctual world. So you're dead. But if you have apramada, then you're watchful, you're mindful, you're responsible. You are an individual. You take a stand. Again, the last words of the Buddha were apamadena sampadeta, which Bhante translates as with mindfulness strive. But apamadena is a compound of apamada, the Pali version of apramada. So the last words of the Buddha were be mindful in this sense, be watchful, be vigilant, watch for the arising of the unskillful and prevent it. Keep the skillful when it's there. Guard it. Those were the last words of the Buddha. And I think it's quite important to draw that out. Otherwise, we identify mindfulness, to my mind, much too narrowly with a sort of a neutral just watching what's going on. Whilst that's important as a basis, it's not the essence of mindfulness. So I do believe that we should take this aspect of mindfulness much more seriously. So, there, I hope that's a helpful survey of the ground. I think it warrants much closer analysis, and I think it'd be good to get quite a number of different sources together to look at these three terms and to fill out more fully what we mean by mindfulness. And I would hope that in the course of that we would draw out much more strongly this aspect of vigilance, of ethical vigilance, which is apramada. The final cluster in the whole series is avihingsa vihingsa. Vihingsa is harm, but actually it's much stronger than that. Hingsa it just itself means harm. Vihingsa, vi is an intensifier, so it means something more like cruelty. Vihingsa is harm to the point of enjoying inflicting it. So it's interesting that this is enumerated separately from advesha, no, pratigha, and advesha, because they are, well, hatred, they're their whole aversive tendency. And vihingsa is clearly the sort of, is dvesha, or pratigha, taken to its furthest extent. Pratigha and dvesha involve the desire to push away the source of suffering. We feel angry, and our anger leads us to want to reject and push away whatever it is that's causing a suffering or that's associated with suffering in our minds. We want to destroy it so that it stops hurting us. But vihingsa is much more intensive than that. It's actually the desire to hurt back. It's not that we just want to stop it. We want the hurter to hurt. We want to cause suffering to those who cause us suffering, or who we at least think cause us suffering. At the worst, it's malice, which is really this taken to the extreme, that you enjoy inflicting suffering. You get pleasure from seeing others in pain, which is a very, very unpleasant emotion indeed, and perhaps the absolute antithesis of Buddhist endeavour. So, vihingsa is the desire to cause pain and suffering. And at its extreme, it's even an enjoyment of it. And of course, it can be done, with the body. You can actually inflict harm on others. Or it can be done with the tongue. You can, speak harshly to them and thereby cause them pain, cause them suffering. As we all know, sticks and stones may hurt my bones, but words hurt even more. Or you can do it more subtle ways, group manipulation. You can sort of create an atmosphere about somebody which they never quite find out that you've said anything about them, but they can be very strongly affected by the mood and atmosphere that you create. Or you can sort of subtly help others to harm that person, and so on. So vihingsa is not just actually sort of directly harming, whether with body or speech, it's also subtly doing so by manipulation and roundabout ways. Often, of course, we try to leave no trace, but all of that is still vihingsa. Avihingsa is just the opposite of that. It's non-harm. It's not even just not harming. It's not even desiring to harm, not even desiring to hurt. You don't even feel like it. So when somebody hurts you, you don't feel like inflicting harm back. You don't feel like retaliating so that they suffer. Indeed, there's a revulsion against it. As avihingsa gets stronger, you feel more and more repelled by the idea of causing suffering to others. And at its most fully developed, it becomes even the desire definitely to remove suffering from others, the desire to help others to overcome suffering. So it's the absolute opposite, absolute antithesis of the desire to hurt, is the desire to take suffering away from others. Wherever you see them suffering, you want to do what you can to remove it. So it becomes karuna. Avihingsa, at its most fully developed, is karuna. And it is very interesting that the whole sequence of positive mental events concludes with avihingsa. In all the conventional recensions, this is the last of the Kushala Chaita Dharmas. So it's very appropriate that we end our survey of the mental events with avihingsa, because it sort of emphasises that knowing your mind does not mean just sort of cutting yourself off from other people and just getting on with your own inner world, as it were. It also means, well, through Advaita, it means loving others, it means Maitri. But more especially in Avihimsa, it means having karuna for them, having compassion for them. So through developing the positive mental events, one is not just retiring into a hermitage necessarily, one is also engaging in compassionate activities, one is doing one's best to help other beings. Sattva Artha Kriyashila, the ethics of benefiting others, is implied in all ethics. It's that the end result of ethics is not merely not doing wrong. It's not merely doing or having positive states. It's actually doing good. It's actually helping others, and especially helping to remove suffering, and especially helping to remove suffering in the ultimate and final way by teaching the Dhamma, by showing the way to the Dhamma. So it's very, very appropriate that the whole set of 51 events ends on this note of Avihimsa, which is really the most the deepest heart of Buddhism. If you could sum up Buddhist practice in one term, it would be compassion. And Avihimsa is that compassion. So we've looked at 51 mental events. I hope that we've at least had a pretty decent survey of them. We've gone into them, well, not as thoroughly as, of course, one could do. We could spend probably 9 days on each and every one of them. But you should at least have a better idea of them, and I hope an idea of the sort of whole picture of how they all fit together. First of all, into those two basic patterns of the mental events that are concerned with the structure of consciousness, how we are conscious, and then those mental events that are to do with skillful and unskillful motivation. So we had, under the first heading of the epistemic mental events, the Savatriga and the Vinyata Chetadharmas, the Savatriga, which are the basic elements of consciousness, and the Vinyata Chetadharma, which are those elements intensified so that we come up closer and closer to the objects of our experience, see them more and more intensively, become more and more deeply united with them, and ultimately see them as they really are. We also saw that those 10 mental events are in themselves not ethically determined. They can be skillful, they can be unskillful, except for, of course, the two that are vipakas, sparsha and vedana. But all the rest are karmic and can be either skillful or unskillful. We saw that like those, there are the four aniyata chetadharmas, which are undetermined, which can be skillful or unskillful according to context. And therefore that it's our effort must be to turn them into something that's skillful. Then we saw in groupings the kushala chetadharmas with the kleshas and the upakleshas. And we saw how each kushala chetadharma, each skillful mental event, is the antidote to a set of kleshas and upakleshas, so that by developing the kushala chetadharma, we can drive out the kleshas and upakleshas. And in the course of that survey, we really had quite a deep look at the Dharma from a certain point of view, and we see it both in its breadth and in its depth. We can see where we're going and what we've got to do. So I hope that's given everybody good tools for clarifying their own spiritual lives. On the retreats that we did in India on this subject, we ended with we'd had quite intensive periods of silence, and on one retreat we had 8 days of silence. And after that silence was over, in the reporting in groups, people were asked to reflect on what they'd learned of their mind during the retreat that far. And I suggested that they came up with at least 5 things. It didn't have to be 5, but it's just useful to have a sort of number to go for. And then 5 things that they felt they really needed to change. And then finally 5 resolutions. And I was very, very pleased with the way this went. Because, well, first of all, I found that I came up with some really good resolutions myself, which made an enormous difference to my life afterwards. But several people told me on subsequent retreats that the resolutions they'd made as a consequence of seeing their minds on those retreats had drastically altered their lives. They'd been able to understand what they needed to be working on in a way they just hadn't been able to clarify before, and thereby to make really radical changes. Because we'd stressed they should be practicable resolutions, not "I will gain enlightenment" or something like that, but "I will meditate 5 times a week," something of that kind. So I feel that this sort of examination, this stock-taking, is a very helpful basis for working out what we need to be working on if we're not clear. And even if we are clear, perhaps it can make us even sharper and more intensely focused on what it is that we need to be doing, so that we can, for at least the next period, sort of give our lives more of a sharp focus and direction. As I've said, I think one of the things that I've observed about order members in general through our chapter retreats is that a lot of people are not sufficiently clear about what they are working on. They are working in a very general way, and they're very sincere and dedicated, but what specifically they're working on in their minds day by day, they're not clear. They tend to think of spiritual life as something you do when you're meditating, which they find difficult because the rest of their life is somewhat at odds with it. So I felt that we all of us, well, many of us at least, need probably to give more thought and attention to this and clarify for ourselves what it is that we're working on. And I think that this schema is very helpful to that end. Of course, it's not the only one. There are other ways of going about it. It's not congenial to all. But I think that it will be for many quite helpful. And as I also said at the beginning, I think it's very obviously a good way to give ourselves a vocabulary for confession and for mutual understanding, so that in our chapters, we don't have to use these terms, but having surveyed these terms, they give us some sort of depth and breadth and fine distinction in analysing our experience, which will help us to express it. Yes, you don't have to sort of come in and officially go through the list. You don't have to come in with a form ticking off the 51 mental events. In the end, you have to use what best expresses your own experience. But having looked at a mapping of this kind, I think one can get a finer gradation of what's going on. One obvious point that does arise from this, and perhaps does arise in the context of us having had a convention retreat rather than a retreat, is that to really see your mind, you need good conditions. And I think that one of the lessons that comes from this sort of survey is that one needs occasionally to put oneself in the ideal conditions for being mindful of what's going on in your mind. I think the conditions we've had here have not been ideal. I think that what we've done has been very, very good, and it's of its unique kind, but it's not been an intensive meditation retreat for observing the mind. But I hope that as a result of doing this, you'll realise that you do need that. You do need to get into certain circumstances where you can watch your mind very closely. I was very alarmed reading an extract from Anguttara Nikaya, in which the Buddha says this: "Without giving up 6 things, O monks, will it not be possible to dwell practicing body contemplation on the body, feeling contemplation on feelings, mind contemplation on mind, mind object contemplation on mind objects?" In other words, to be mindful of the 4 foundations. Which are these 6? To be fond of activity, to be fond of talking, to be fond of sleeping, to be fond of company, lack of sense control, immoderate eating. Well, you go on retreat to restrict activity. You go on retreat to restrict talking. When you're on retreat, hopefully you'll need to sleep less and you won't indulge in sleeping. Yes, there's company there, but it's not group, it's community. So your fondness for company is not satisfied. Lack of sense control on retreat, you limit the input, and hopefully you're in very beautiful surroundings so that your sense experience is uplifted sense experience. And of course on retreat, ideally, you don't eat immoderately. So I thought this was a pretty sort of pertinent listing, and one that we all need to apply even in our ordinary lives. But from time to time, we need to get away, give ourselves these sort of conditions, without a lot of activity, without a lot of talking, not sleeping too much, without just socialising and grouping, with controlling our sensory input and eating moderately. That is a retreat, and without it, the Buddha says, you cannot be clearly comprehending what's going on in your body, speech and mind. So if we want to develop mindfulness, if we want to do Dhamma Vichaya, we need to give ourselves those conditions. We haven't been able to now, we knew that at the start. But perhaps that's one lesson at least that we can learn from this sort of setting. I know a number of people have said to me they found it very difficult to do the reflections because their minds were sort of full of what they'd been thinking about and talking about during the day. And talking is good, but it's a bit incompatible with a finer tuning of one's mindfulness. So I think we should all be mindful of that. Of course, we can be watching our minds all the time. That's what we should be doing. In every action, we should be applying smriti, samprajanya, and apramada on the basis of our shraddha and our virya. But we need to go on retreat pretty frequently. I would say much more than most order members do. So often people say to me, I'm not inspired, I can't do my meditation practice. My first question is always, when were you last on retreat? And it's almost always a year ago, 2 years ago, or whatever. If you're uninspired, if you're not getting on well with your meditation and you haven't been on retreat for the last 6 months, there's your answer. So yes, we should remember this. But at the same time, we should be trying to work on our mindfulness in every area of our lives. And especially, I think we should be trying to use our chapters to aid our efforts to be much more mindful, especially by cultivating in our chapters pre and apatrapya through confession, through confiding, through opening up. If we do that, if we take advantage of retreats, if we attempt to be mindful in our daily lives, and especially if we use our chapters as arenas for intensifying moral awareness, well, then we will fulfill the vows that we undertook at ordination, and we'll feel a sense of satisfaction and happiness with ourselves. We'll feel that our lives are really being fulfilled.